Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why episode 280, my conversation with Australian improviser Amanda Buckley. But first, let's talk about our sponsors. Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. Sign up today for your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. You get a free audiobook download as well as access to hundreds of books and podcasts. You know, right now I am working on a larger story and I have used Audible to find books that I can research, that I can get information about the world that I'm trying to write about or lore and stuff like that. It's been super helpful. And, you know, with the kiddo around, I really can use the listening. It just like helps me soak it in while I'm doing other things. And hey, don't forget, you can listen to Yes But Why through Audible. It's pretty solid. Go now to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy to sign up and get your account today. Yes But Why podcast is also brought to you by PodcastCadet.com. PodcastCadet.com is the company that my husband Chris and I run to help podcasters. We are here to connect you to the larger podcasting community. If there's some information that you need and we know the person who like invented it or like is the expert on it, we're going to connect you to that person. We're going to give you the benefit of their knowledge so that you can become a better podcaster. We like to meet people and we are out there going to podcasting festivals. So we're connected and we just want to help. So give us a call and let us know what we can do and we'll find the people that are the best people to help you so that you can really put out some quality content. Mention code YBY20 and you can get 20% off the first service or workshop you buy. We can help you. PodcastCadet.com. Yes But Why podcast is also brought to you by True Hemp Science. True Hemp Science is my resource for vegan-friendly whole plant extract CBD oil. Check out TrueHempScience.com to see all the CBD products available to you now. Use code YESBUTWHY7 to get 7% off your order of $50 or more. Plus, you'll get a free packet of CBD edibles with your order. TrueHempScience.com. This week on Yes But Why podcast, I am excited to present my conversation with Australian improviser Amanda Buckley. Listen in as we talk about the ups and downs of being loud and delightful. We gab about improv festivals and how we were both at the Del Close Marathon in New York City in 2010, but we've never met. Tune in and enjoy this conversation as much as we did. I now present to you Yes But Why episode 280, Amanda Buckley, dramatic since birth. Enjoy. I'm Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why podcast. Yeah. We are all creative when we are children, and I feel like what happens in our childhood really informs who we are as an artist, you know, and what we did and what we were interested in. So as the first insight into Amanda Buckley, tell me, what were you like as a creative kid?
Actually, I had a very dramatic birth.
Really? So
I actually think that and there's a period of my life where I have heard my birth story many, many times. And so rather than it being obviously something that I remember, it's something that I have learned. And because of hearing the word dramatic, I just believed, I think, that I was a dramatic child. So I was a very, I'm the youngest of three. I'm apparently always like came out talking, even though it was a very dramatic birth.
That was what was dramatic about it. You were doing a song and dance number. They were very surprised.
Yeah, kind of.
Where did she get that stick? I don't, she's dancing.
No wonder her mum looks a mess. So my mother nearly died. I was 10 weeks premature in 1975. So it was a pretty big deal for back then, not so big a deal these days. But my mother almost died. They weren't sure if I was going to make it, and yeah, very dramatic. So yeah, I think I just lapped that up. I absorbed it. And so if ever there was a chance for me to make sure everyone knew I was in a room, I did. And I think that's kind of definitive of what my childhood was like. I was very loud. Apparently, I was always very delightful, but very loud. And yeah, as soon as I got to school, that became very apparent too. So the loud girl gets to do the readings in class. The loud girl gets to, you know, I just naturally, it feels weird to say it, but I think I had a natural confidence because I just believed I was dramatic. So.
Yeah.
Hopefully that didn't make me precocious. I don't think I was. I think I was also a little bit too goofy, and I was a bit of a chubby kid, and I wasn't very athletic. And even though I did, it's called physical culture here. I'm not sure if it's something in the States, but it's a mix of calisthenics and maybe ballet. But, you know, I was terrible at it, but I loved being there. So I think I just gave a lot of energy. So regardless of whether or not I was had any skill, I think I always gave off this dramatic flair that people quite enjoyed. So, yeah, it was dramatic. In terms of anything else creative, I'm not a maker. I was never a drawer. I couldn't sit and do puzzles, or I wasn't crafty. I just was loud.
But you talk to people, right? You're at your family's parties. Were you the one getting them to tell the story? Come, let's talk about me. Did you know I was a dramatic birth? And then your dad comes over and you're like, you're just saying it along with him.
Yeah.
He's like, it was a dark and stormy night. It was very dark. It was very stormy. You remember.
Exactly.
You were there.
It's all about the details.
Yeah.
Actually, there is a funny... there's a bit of a family story. I'm terrified of aliens. So that's my greatest fear is aliens. And it all comes back to the BBC recording in the 70s, the BBC recording with Richard Burton of War of the Worlds.
Legit.
Yeah, right. Because whenever there was some sort of family gathering, or we had, you know, just friends or people over, just before we would all go to bed, I would like to, you know, while the parents were allowed to drink their port or have some of their trifle or tiramisu. We would never have had tiramisu. It would have been, you were lucky. It would have been a pavlova probably. But before the kids were sent to bed, I think I used to have a habit of going, can I just do this one thing? Like, and I would be in the middle of the lounge and, can I just do this one thing? And Dad used to, while I was, you know, demanding the attention of the audience, he would press play on War of the Worlds and I would turn to water. I would freak out. I would go, you know, screaming, why would you do this? Why would you do this? And so my dad used to usurp, obviously, my moment by turning me into a blubbering mess. But I can, even the beginning of it now, I can still start to get, I can't watch any of these amazing new series. I try to, I'll watch one episode and they go, nope, too scary. The moment the aliens come, I'm done. No, sorry.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff you can't watch. I should press make you a list. I've watched all of them. We're very much into the sci-fi and the alien. I'll be like, shows you should avoid. Also, this one you should avoid. They don't tell you it's aliens till the end. Let me tell you not to watch it.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, that's a good one. That's a good point.
There's a few where you're like, what's going on? Seems like a weird situation. And then you're like, right? So, yeah, I mean, I would blame your dad on this whole thing. I mean, playing it repeatedly, it's like, that's rough. I mean, don't get me wrong. Listen, I don't know if you have children, but I have children and they do not like to go to bed, and they do often have one more thing. And so it's tough. And there's a lot of like, no more things. Get in your room. Let's go. Come on, brush your teeth. And it's like, okay, but first just one.
Stab me for life.
Yeah. Well, you know, 70s makes sense.
Yeah.
The 70s definitely. And 80s parenting across cross-cultural. I know we're from other sides of the literal earth, but I can guarantee that our parents made very similar bad decisions, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was like there was one parenting book, and it was by that Spock guy, right? Who until like maybe when I had my child, I thought was like a Star Trek thing. Like I was like, why did everybody read a Star Trek baby book? And then when I got pregnant and someone like sent me a thing about how I shouldn't read the book, I was like, this is a different actual human. This is not a character I definitely thought this was Star Trek fan fiction and people got it wrong. Oh, wow. He's just a bad advice fella. Okay, well, that's crazy. You know, but it's like anything, you know, the world changes, the way you look at it changes. Now these days you see a kid want to perform and you're like, get up on a stage. You can do it, kid. But back in the day, they were like, shh, listen, no one wants an artist. Like, become a lawyer if you want to talk. And you're like, okay.
Definitely. Well, that's what I think my parents really thought. For a long time, I thought I was going to get into journalism.
Sure.
And then I got very much into the idea that I might get into law. And my parents were all for it. They were thinking, well, you know, she's got that strong personality for it. But no, when I broke the news to them that I had found a drama school to go to, I think they, because I'd always been a part of the school productions. But it was, I think, literally just because they knew that the audience would hear me. So I got cast in lots of things. Oh, well, we'll just make her the narrator.
It's important.
Because then they'll hear. But it's a male role. You know what? But none of the boys want to do it. We'll give it to her. Mm-hmm. So there's a long line of school productions. And, you know, I did believe my press. I was, again, hopefully not precocious. I just think I was, I gave out good energy, I would like to think. The good energy. But yes, my parents.
Hey man, it's your life. I mean, you keep saying, I hope I'm not precocious. And I was like, gosh, I don't know that anyone is like, I was a real precocious kid. Like I feel like that's a level of self-hatred. Like, do some adults, like precocious was invented by the adults that didn't like children. Like they're all like, does he always speak? He's so precocious. And you're like, he literally never stops talking at all times. Yeah. Is that a problem for you? You probably shouldn't come over anymore.
We cannot be friends from now until probably ever.
I don't know. I got a boy. He is gregarious right now at age 4. But, you know, if I know boys, he'll stop talking to me in about 10 years. So it's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine. And, you know, I'll listen to all the stories now. And then later when he's 14, 15 and he's in his room, I'll just be like, hey, did you want to talk? What's going on in there? Remember when we used to talk and you'd tell me stories? Let's do that now.
Be like, leave me alone, Mom.
Mine is 10. My boy is 10 and I'm hugging him a little bit too long. Okay, that's enough, Mum. That's enough, Mum. Nice. I barely got my arms around you. I barely got my 20 seconds. 20 seconds and the endorphins rush. Come on. It's just not interesting. But, you know.
You know those signs about how long you should be washing your hands? That's how long you should be hugging your mother.
It's for your health. It's true. It is for your health.
It is for your health. It's helpful. Yeah. It really is. So sounds like from the story, when you told your parents you were going to go to drama school, they were not exactly having a, oh my God, I'm so excited. We're having an actor party. It wasn't, being an actor was not an option, not to you, clearly it was, but like in the world, did you have any, you know, friends or family growing up who did something like that? Or was it so foreign to them that they were just like, where are you going? Safari? And you're like, no, theater school. Like,
yeah, right. And I think that's the thing, is that they just didn't know what to do with me.
Yeah.
It's not that they weren't supportive. In fact, apart from scarring me for life with some More of the World's action, mm-hmm. they actually are ridiculously, ridiculously supportive emotionally. But the one thing they did do at that point is say, well, if you want to do that, that's great, but we can't finance that. So you'll have to find a way at 16 to make that happen. And of course, the other thing my dad used to say to me always, and God bless him, I'm the youngest and I have an older sister, And people did refer to our family as which sister was which by saying the pretty one and the loud one. And it's a lot to take in when you're, you know, a kid is like, oh, I guess I'm the loud one. But my dad, I know, my poor sister is more than just pretty. Like, my sister is amazing, but she also just heard that. So for any listeners, it's a double-edged sword, because while my sister was hearing that and developing a whole world of issues around being defined by her appearance, I didn't know, I was just jealous. But my dad spent a lot of time kind of with me, making sure that I knew I could be anything, you know, like he just built my confidence up really, really well. Apart from scaring the you know, apart from scarring me for life, but he really did make a point, of saying, well, you can do anything. Like, you're smart, you're funny. You know how to use your voice and stand up for yourself. So I very much champion him for cultivating that in me. So even though they said they wouldn't finance it, they had at some point helped me develop some ridiculous self-esteem and confidence. And I was like, well, I'm not asking you for money. In fact, I'm not even asking you for permission. I've got myself a job in a video store back in 1989. They were called video stores. And I financed it myself. And I used to catch the bus on a Saturday to the drama school. And this was in the suburbs of Sydney. I grew up in the southwestern suburbs, which isn't exactly known as a cultural hub of arts.
At a drama school.
That's right. So I found this drama school, and you know, it's, that school is no longer with us now. I'm pretty sure it ran away with most of our money. And that happened to me a few times, just because I didn't know. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know what to do. But it didn't mean I wasn't learning. I just wasn't necessarily in what people would consider, I guess, the legit schools, you know, the NIDAs or the Actors Centre. I was just doing the rounds in like the suburban drama schools.
Don't listen to judgment about one school versus another school. I mean, if there's people teaching theater and they care with their heart, then it's good enough. Like, just because you don't have, oh, I didn't go to the top art school, whatever. Like,
yeah,
there's like most of the schools that think they're the best don't even do arts because they're above that or whatever. So, I mean, at the end of the day, if you had a good experience, if they didn't hurt you and you like ended with some knowledge, then the experience is good. I mean, I went from crazy job to crazy job where, you know, sometimes I was working on plays, not making money, just to do stuff, just to be involved, you know, and it was like, no one saw this. Why? We just did this play. There's three people in this audience, but you know, who cares? I learned how to do different stuff. I had the experiences. So you said Saturdays. Does that mean that like the drama school was just a weekend thing?
Yeah, I was at school still. I was still a school student.
Oh, all right.
And so I did that in my last 2 years of school. I used to do that on the weekends. And then it became a night school because I graduated and moved up to the adult classes, which were in the evenings, because that's when adults learn, is in the evenings.
Indeed.
But it meant that I could still work. So I had, you know, whatever jobs I could to fund this passion. And it really was, I mean, that is one of the great things. I might not have been the elite schools that everyone hears of, but all it did was keep that fire. It kept stoking it and it kept giving me more to hang on to. I'm really proud that I paid for it myself, you know, like,
yeah.
I think it gave me a sense of this is mine now. I'm on this journey and I'm making it happen. And it's about how much I put into it. But it's, yeah, from there I did amateur stuff because that's, of course, where these schools lead to. And like you said, it's doing, you know, plays where you're not getting money. It's in a town hall or it might be in a function center of a something and you're just lucky to get the space. And it's, you know, for these 10 nights only. And then you meet a whole other group of people and some of them have different experiences and advice for you to go and check this out. And that is the stream that I got into improv through, because on one of the amateur theatre productions that I was in, I met someone who was, you know, had been doing improv for a while and they had said, you know, you're a natural improviser. And I said, you know, I love improv. I just never, I wouldn't even know like where to do classes. And so they said, well, you do them here. And that was it. And actually that was the moment. I was probably 23 by that stage, plodding along, doing little bits and pieces. I had a terrible agent. I'd managed to get myself an agent and she was terrible, but she was fabulous, but disgraceful. And she would just send me for stuff. And I get a phone call from her and she, I mean, literally she would say, you're the fat Amanda, aren't you? Great. I've got one for you. And she would send me to an audition. And do you know what though? I was just like, yes, I am. I'm the fat Amanda. You're sending me to that.
You're like, that is the Amanda you're looking for, right? Then it's me.
Yeah, please don't be any other Amanda. I knew this.
Oh my God.
So yeah, I was just
so terrible.
It was. Looking back, it was the most horrendous thing, but I loved it though still. Mm-hmm. That mix of hating myself, but also like living my dream.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Yeah. I've taken all manner of abuse under the guise of I'm doing theater. There have been so many occasions where I've been like, wow, this person is really mean all the time. Well, it's a play. Guess that's what happens. Yeah. Like so much. And it was like only when I was an adult and I told some other people and they were like, what? He did what? That's not all right. Oh, it's not? Oh, okay. Well, I didn't say anything. I just waited.
Right.
He yelled for a while. I took notes on what he yelled about. And then I said, okay. I was a stage manager for a long time.
Oh, my goodness.
So I was the organizer, and I got a lot of the brunt of insanity. Yeah. And so there was just a lot of me wide-eyed writing down whatever anyone told me and then trying to process it after. I'd be like, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sure, absolutely. Yes. Thank you. And I'd walk away and I'd be like, what did I write down? Oh, there's 4 insults to me. Oh, let's cross those off. I don't have to do that. Okay. Like,
it is mind boggling, isn't it? What we put up with to a point.
Yeah.
But also, you know, hopefully we do know better now, like the generations after us and younger people now know, but yeah, you don't have to put up with certain things, but I feel like there's so few opportunities sometimes that you feel like, well, if I say anything, it'll be someone else will be copying this abuse. And I want it to be me that's copying the abuse because this is, I want this job, you know?
Yeah.
Which is insane.
Did you know that I'm at an elite place receiving abuse? Like this is on my resume, you guys.
This is Sydney's best abuse. Okay. It doesn't get better than this. This is A grade.
People come from all across the world to be abused here. You know that no one's paid, right? No one, not even the famous people. Nope. Mm-mm. They just keep all the money. It's great. It's great. It's egalitarian. Yeah. 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 It's funny. Yeah. You know, the beauty of things like this podcast and also like the internet and being able to talk to each other is that it helps us help each other not have to deal with that level of abuse. I mean, yeah. I remember I had I was an assistant stage manager. I had a stage manager that I was working for and she would just belittle me every time I did something. And I was really confused because I always just did what she told me to do. And then I was like, I wonder what it is about me that she doesn't like. And then I went and spoke to like our supervisor, like the person who was in charge of all the plays. And I was like, listen, I'm real worried I'm not doing my job right. And, you know, she tells me this, this, and this. Is there something I can do better? And they were like, oh, my God, she's just a jerk. You're great. Don't worry about it. Keep doing your job. She's just angry about literally everything. Like, it's not you. And I was like, oh, all right. Great. That's a weight off my shoulders. I was very concerned. I didn't know how to do my job. Whew, thank you. All right. And what's funny was literally just that person telling me, oh, no, she's just does that. She just yells for no reason. It's not you. It like made it better. Like I was like, oh, that's fine. That's fine. Okay, cool. I can handle that then. You know what I mean? Like we do. We handle this level of, you know, like just people being jerks or like they make you pay for your whole costume and makeup and everything. And you're like, What part did you bring to the theater? Do you just, this is your mom's basement and we're here doing a play. I brought the chairs, okay, and, you know, the curtain. So, you know, yeah, there's a lot of stuff like that where it's like, Well, the other part of it that I was thinking, too, is it's like the other thing that I would hope that people, at least these days, could be more empowered to do is if all of the options that you have in your city or wherever are people who are mean and not crowds that you want to hang with, you can just do your own thing. Like, it is way easier than I thought. It was years before I was like, wait, all I have to do is get the script and buy the rights for a period of time and then I can do that play? Oh. Like, once I found the freedom of literally just like paying a quick, you know, 50 to Samuel French, I was like, guys, we're doing a play. I don't know where. I don't know how, but we're going to do it. I got to figure it out. And it like freed me up from having to be under the thumb of the, you know, angry and weary.
Yeah. And it is exhausting because even just the idea of, you know, producing your own production, like, yes, you can choose the lesser of two evils if you want to. Like, if you're not, if you still just desperately want to be in something, but you don't want to do all of the work as the admin and the casting and the directing and the everything, well, then that is an option for you is to, okay, but it'd be nice to know that you could draw a line in the sand to, you know, what behaviors are acceptable, especially when no one's getting paid. But if you really, really want to do something and you really, really have had enough and you're, you know, looking around you and thinking, I think I could do better, have a go. You know, what's the worst that can happen is that it's a flop. Well, guess what? The production you were probably in with all those, you know, jerks possibly wasn't very successful either. So
right.
You've got nothing to lose except, yes, maybe some money, but we've all been there. And the lessons learned along the way are amazing, you know?
Yeah.
It took me a really long time to feel like, even just from an improv point, you know, perspective, I joined companies in Sydney and I did shows with all of them. And, you know, you built up your troupe, not necessarily teams, but, you know, like an ensemble of people that you just felt safe with and comfortable with. But you would, you know, after a couple of years, you start to feel a little bit like, I want more. I want to do something else. I want to do something else. And it only takes one person to say, I've got an application for a festival. I'm thinking of a new format. I'd like to put it in this festival, which is how we do things over here a lot. And suddenly, like, three or four people that you really trust, you can say, would you like to? We all put in $50 each. There's the rego fee taken care of. And suddenly, just, like, everything feels possible. And you're doing a thing with a group of people that you really, really like, that you can work, that you can feel really, really proud of. You may get your money back. But I don't think anyone regrets the $50 spend for the huge give back, which then empowers you to do the next project. And eventually you do get your money back and eventually you start making little profits. And then for people who are really, really confident and, oh, not confident, but really like feeling really, really empowered, they can actually turn that into running their own spaces and suddenly they're programming their own venue and they've got their own list of shows of people that they trust too. And you can get rid of all of those jerks eventually. You can program them out of your community, hopefully. That's the goal.
Yeah, absolutely. I like your whole full plan there. That was like, I was like, yeah, you're solving it. This is how it develops. No, I wanted to ask you, so you got involved with improv and did you stick with one school or did you take multiple classes all around?
The scene was back in late 90s, early 2000s here in Sydney. It was very, very small. There was really only one school. So I'd done, by that stage, would have been in my early 20s, I'd done a heap of theatre training and I had gone to a lot of different schools. I'd gone to a theatre school, I'd gone to a film school, I'd done camera workshops, I'd done audition workshops, I'd done vocal training. I had started singing. I'd started with a singing coach. Wow. I'd done a lot of plays, like amateur plays, and but there really was only one big improv school in Sydney, and that's Impro Australia, it's called. It still exists. And so I actually just did their first two levels. Their general vibe of the improv at the time was more kind of Johnstone based and theatre sports based. I did my first two levels, which was just intro to improv and then let's learn the games. That was about the level of training I had before I started performing. And I was really, really lucky that I'd like to think, and this is something for people, I heard another improviser say only last week on a podcast that she gets asked to do things because she's the token female and person of color. And everybody was like, no, that's not true. And this, I have often said that I think I was a token female at the time to get cast into things. There weren't a lot of female improvisers back then. And I was one that could stand in the middle of the stage and had theatre training so you could see my face. And most importantly, the big thing that comes back for Amanda Buckley is you could hear me. It didn't matter where you were in the room, you could hear me. That dramatic, loud child had found a home. But as a friend of mine said, I might have stood out as a female, which made people look at me. It's always handy to have a woman in the cast. But I got asked back because of my skills, not because I was a woman. So
you had a lot of skills. It's a lot of training you've just described. It's like, yeah. Wow, I haven't done maybe like a third of that. Like, wow, it's a singing coach and, you know, oh, my God, whew, that's a lot.
I was trying often back then as well to just add as many strings to the bow as I could because I was only getting auditions as the fat girl, really.
Sure.
And so I wanted to at least nail those because they're few and far between roles and there's never more than one in a cast. You know, heaven forbid we have more than two people who are over the normal actor's average size, which we know you don't have to be very big to be considered the big girl in acting.
I am.
And, you know, at that age, I was just trying anything to be more skillful. And in Australia, a lot, maybe not so much now, but definitely back then, a lot of the improvisers were trained actors. So we had much more of a theatre background. And so there was a groundswell of people who were actually theatre people before they were improvisers. And that is, I took the classes originally to have some fun and add some skills, but to get better at auditioning. But what happened was I just found the place where I felt this is my home. And I think it was because for the first time there was any role was available to me. I could be anything. And so suddenly I felt like all of those skills that I had, you know, I could actually use here because I wasn't just the token big girl. I wasn't just the best friend role. I wasn't just the evil character, the grotesque character. I could be any of those things. And that felt like coming home, you know, for the first time that I could be. The first time I remember being in a scene with someone where, you know, it was romantic, even though I'd read all the romantic monologues and even though in drama classes, you know, you do a scene study and it might have been a romance, I would never be cast as a romantic character. So to actually be in a show where I'm in a romantic position with, you know, the lead guy, just even for those short scenes where it might only be, you know, 2 minutes of just being that, I just was... Oh, my heart burst. I loved it. I was like, wow, you can be all the things except an animal. I don't like playing animals. I know that's very anti improv, but I don't like getting on the floor and getting back up again. So if you're going to endow me as an animal, that animal will be standing.
Mm-hmm. Lemur.
Just
okay.
For reference. Yeah, great. There's my Jodie Block.
Yeah, just call her a lemur. That's all she can do. It's funny. I love that distinction. You're like, but no animals. Listen, I'm very open. No animals. I will not act like an animal.
Yeah, shoot me on stage. I will die slowly as I find the chair to sit on. I don't want to lie on the floor, guys. These are good pants.
Oh my God, it's so funny. Oh, I love that. You know, it's funny. I've taught so many classes and I always find those little distinctions so fun in a group, like the people who will be the big physical people and the people who just like immediately just find the chair and just sit in it. And I'm like, yeah, she's a sitter. That's what she does, you know? And then some people, you know, they always make themselves like, you know, inanimate objects or like concepts. Yeah, right. Like, they're like, I'm the concept of loneliness. And you're like, well, all right. Guess that's who's here at the party.
Seat in Paris on the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, all right, sure. I guess you are. I taught a class one time that was like, it was 12 people and it was 11 20 somethings and one woman in her 80s. And it was a true lesson in like, and I actually aided me in future teaching, but like she always, when she was allowed to endow herself, she would always make herself a child or an animal. Always.
Yeah, right.
The animal didn't crawl around. She stood there, whatever. But she loved being an animal, or she loved being like a kid. Like she'd be like, mommy. And she did it every time. It was just the what she wanted to play. And every time someone else endowed her, she was the grandmother.
Right.
Every single time.
Oh, wow.
After about the 50th time of them endowing her as a grandmother, I started this exercise where I would assign everybody in the room a different person, and I would give them cards and not tell them who had who, and I would tell them to watch that person and learn from what they do about what they like in scenes, what they repeatedly do, and what something good that they did. So at the end, I was like, what I want you guys to tell me, I'm going to ask you, what are the things this person likes to do on stage and what are they great at? Right. And then they'd focus on this person. And then I wasn't the only one watching her make herself a child or an animal and not wanting to be a grandmother. So they were like, oh, hey, they were like, you know what? You're really great. When you played that chocolate bar, it was really funny. And I feel like you were super spot on. And so it really helped. And after that, I was like, well, I'm just going to do this with my classes all the time. So like 3/4 of the way through class, like an 8-week class, I do that with them so
amazing.
That they connect with each other on a larger, first of all, after 4 or 5 classes, you like know what you're trying to do. And then at that point, you're like actively trying to do it. What moves can I make to make this better? And I think focusing on your partners makes it better.
Yeah. And it also, by that stage, you would be hoping that trust is being developed.
Yeah.
But if people haven't noticed yet, it's just that little extra way that you can reassure them that they've got each other's backs, you know, like you're not out here on a limb by yourself. But if no one's noticing because we're all still so nervous, I mean, geez, you know, I just think anyone taking classes as an adult, you know, I mean, I knew my journey. I knew where I was headed in a weird way because there was, you know, a little bit of a map happening where, oh, well, if I do this, that means after that I do this and after that. So me coming to improv, really, when I look at the whole map, yeah, I was probably going to end up there somehow. But for some of these people that turn up to our classes, you know, what are you doing here? You're successful in your life. Why are you here? And it's the same. I love it. This the... I mean, they're running into the fear, really, aren't they? But they're some of them never get past it, so we have to really help them find those connections and trust.
So you've talked about the improv training that you had and that you started getting involved in performing, but at this point in your career, you are teaching it. How did it evolve into that?
When I left Sydney, actually, so 10 years ago, I fell pregnant with my child, and a very long story for another time, Amy, but it meant that I had to move cities to actually be with the father of my child, as we were a long distance relationship for quite a few years. And we met through improv. We met doing shows at festivals, and I think we've been together a good 4 years. And anyway, I had to move cities, and I'd moved from Sydney where, so I'd had a close to 10 years of improv performance doing festivals. It did definitely assist my other acting work. So I did have other acting work that I was doing. I was always doing other jobs on the side. It's the improv scene here is not as, and I can appreciate that it's not financially sound for so many Americans either, but there was really not a lot of money at all in improv in Australia. So there's always like a side hustle. And I had gotten into voiceovers by that stage and quite a few different things, but it took moving cities actually. And I moved down to Melbourne and I joined Impro Melbourne down here. It was the big company down here. There's a few different companies now across Australia that have popped up in the last 10 years as people have done exactly, you know, what you've said. Not that there were any jerks necessarily or anything like that, but people just started thinking, I want something else. I want to try something else. And the world kind of got smaller. So people started getting more influences from the States, and we were at the Dill Close Marathon in 2010 together.
That's so crazy.
I know.
I so couldn't believe that when I posted that picture and you were like, I was also there. Like, what?
Yeah, I knew you looked familiar. No.
I mean, but it was such a huge affair. I mean, there's, it's so we huge, could have met, yes. But we have also potentially could have never met. Like, there was so exactly. much going on. Oh,
I remember
wow.
describing it to Jonathan Pitts, and he was like, yeah, I was there. I don't know if you've talked with Jonathan Pitts before, but we were describing, so he's a Chicago improviser and teacher, and we were describing the party, the room, the building, the empty shop they'd found for us to have parties in 2010. But yes, because I moved cities and I was bringing with me my experiences, getting back on track, people down here wanted to know what I'd done up there. I mean, Australia's small in terms of the communities. There's not a huge amount. So most of us have all met each other at various festivals, but they wanted to know what I did when I was in Dill Close Marathon. Okay, so what? Oh, you've worked with that person, and that person came to Sydney, but they didn't come to Melbourne. And what did you learn there? So I kind of got into teaching by just being not from here, and it took me ages to consider myself a legit teacher. I felt like I had to. I'd been running jams, and I'd been, you know, directing seasons of things that, you know, formats that I'd made up, but I still didn't think of myself as a teacher until I had a group of complete, and I'd done heaps of corporate work. I've done a lot of corporate improv. That's where the money is, people. And yeah, that's, yeah.
It's also where the real true transformation is.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of improvisers don't like it. They just feel like, oh, I've got to do this corporate improv. I love it because I just think, like, if I can get two stiff, prejudiced old white guys to be silly, well, I've done my job.
They need it more than we do. They need it more than we do.
Yeah. So I still had not considered myself a teacher until I had a full class of complete, you know, general public paying money to do level one, what is improv. Bizarre that I couldn't call myself a teacher until I'd done that. So strange. But yeah, so I think people just started asking me to teach and run things because, you know, I do have some years on the board, so I have some experience, but that doesn't make you a teacher. Like, don't think just because you've been doing something for ages that you can impart any wisdom. And I think that's, I just kept thinking, well, I'm not a qualified teacher, but thankfully I think what I do have is an interest in people. And so that made it easier for me to be open-minded in a room and, well, not easier. I like seeing people do things, and all the corporate training that I had done had kind of geared me up to teaching those fresh people coming in, to just let them play. The weird thing is over the last 2 years, I've barely taught because I don't know why. I think it's because I get my energy from people. I just really find it hard to translate anything over I can talk like this with you, Amy. I think we've actually, over the course of the many hours that we've been talking before and after this podcast record actually happened, that, you know, I love talking to people and I can talk one-on-one with you, but I really find, you know, any more than two people on a Zoom, I just struggle to feel like I'm connecting. And so I'm not present and I'm not doing all those things that I want to be doing in a room. So
yeah,
it feels like a long time since I've done real, you know, anything that I would consider teaching, and I would love to get back there. But
I haven't done a ton.
Yeah. It's just getting all those people back in a room still is a bit weird, isn't it?
Oh yeah, no, it's not going to happen for a little bit. But no, I mean, I've tried to do some Zoom teaching, but the only things that I really got going, I would say the best stuff, like you mentioned, the one-on-one stuff. I've done some one-on-one writing, and that has been really great, because like then it's not just like, hi, I'm teaching a course and maybe you connect with it. It's like, hey, what are you doing that I can help you write? And they're like, I have this project. And I'm like, cool, I'll make sure to know everything about how to do that project. Or like, yeah, I've written six of those. Let's talk about it. Right. So that's how it's worked for me. I did teach one kids improv class where there were three little girls who were eight who were all on Zoom with me. And that took a while to get used to, but we eventually, it felt regular. You know, we did it for the whole year, last school year. In the afternoons, like once a week in the afternoons. And it was great. We had a good time.
Yeah.
It was an excellent reprieve for all of us, I think. And then what else did I do? I did one more. I've taken classes that felt better. Like I've had teachers who were handling it. Not that I'm not handling it. I'm fine. But like, I just like people who have really, you know, people that we know, I'm sure mutually, where it's like they're just hustling to get those classes out and they're doing it and it's happening. Yeah. And I'm like, cool, great. What are you doing? I'll watch or like I'll play. But like to lead it with a bunch of people is really hard. Oh, also, I did this one class. It was very unusual to do it this way.
I love your tone change. I love the tone change. And also there was this one time.
I worked for this theater and it was high school kids, which I like. They weren't the problem. The problem was that I was set up as they were all in the same room and I was a TV in that room. And they were great. I mean, they were respectful and they did all the right things. And heck, they fixed the technology three or four times for us. But at the same time, it was harder for me to connect with them. Yes. I enjoyed that they had more opportunity to connect with each other, because it was like there was like a theater pod of people who were at the very beginning were like, listen, these are the 12 kids that do the plays every year at this theater. Let's just do a thing for them. And they like would do their virtual schooling during the day and then just all go to the theater at night. So it was like they didn't see anybody else but each other. So it was safer for them to be around each other. But at the same time, it was like then, you know, me, Max Headroom reference, was like on the wall being all like, let me teach you improv, improv, improv. You know, like it was, and there was one class that it cut out like three quarters of the way through and no one ever reconnected with me ever. And no one even sent me a text to be like, hey, we can't get the computer to work. Like, we're just going to not have the rest of class. I was just like waiting and I was like,
I'm here.
It's like my stuff all works, right? Is the internet on? Yeah. Okay. Like, you know, so I would say that I tried to experience it in as many ways as I could, and it got a little weird for sure, but, you know, tried.
Oh, I think that's a really important thing, though, is being able to name what works for you and what doesn't.
Yeah.
And I felt really quite, I just felt relief when I named it, because let's face it, we've all been exhausted. Creative is different for everybody. How we create, how we connect is so personal. And I really struggled. I just could not do it. And so to actually just admit it and just go, I don't have to force this. I can't. This is like, if it's earning me any money, it's not much. but it's costing me energy and I'm exhausted anyway. So I'm going to put that energy into something else. And it's strange because I still needed to create, but I just couldn't create that way anymore. Like strangely, I know I said that I'm not crafty, but I took up sewing and I just started sewing.
I
became crafty last year. But I felt like that at least ticked a box. And it was very mindful for me as well. I'm not one for meditation, unfortunately, because I'm very loud and the voices in my head are very loud. But if I'm sewing, I can't think of anything else except not hurting my fingers by sewing myself into the garment. So it was a moment of mindfulness for me of not focusing on anything else except the thing I'm making. But I do miss miss that. My big thing is with teaching in particular is musical improv.
Ooh.
Because I'm a trained singer, it just married up with all my worlds came to a. I saw Baby Wants Candy at I always loved musical improv anyway, but I saw Baby Wants Candy at the Del Close Marathon, and just was like, wow! So they can they can be good shows. They could be good shows. Oh my god, there's a way to do it, and it's just by. Oh, I just loved it so much. And I came home thinking how can I help other people love musical improv the way I love it? And that's the big thing that I teach when I get the chance now. It's not through a school. I've got a mate I work with, an accompanist, who's also just my partner in musical improv work. Jamie Burgess, his name is, and we work together because we just love it. You don't have to be able to sing. I mean, if you can, it's amazing, but you don't have to. If you're worried that you're not a very good actor, it's okay because the music does the work for you. Like, there's just all these amazing things about why you should love it. So that's where I just, when I can, when it's safe, that's where I'll be happy to just launch back into teaching musical improv again at some stage when the time is right.
Yeah. Man, that sounds so great. I had a musical improv troupe at one point, and it was like we all took a workshop from a random guy that came into town, and then we just decided the people in the workshop were going to start a troupe together, and we did,
yeah,
and
great.
It was great, but we kind of figured out a lot of the mechanics on our own, like, because the workshop was very beginner in the way that it was all like, yeah, just sing whatever you want, and we were like, okay, but what happens? And so then we all did research on our own about like what styles of songs we could create, and then we would come in and be like, okay guys, here's a way that we could do this. And my thing that I really liked, I'm a big structure hound, like I like it when I feel like I've got a grasp on where we are in the path of the structure, stuff like that. And with musical improv, when we discussed and created for ourselves, I still don't know if anything that we created is like a regular real thing, but like the framework of songs, you would know from the first thing that person sang what kind of framework. We had like four, and you would know from what they said what the path of it is. It's like, okay, am I supposed to let him sing for a long time and then just back him up with a little doo-wop? Or like, is my character in contrast with him and we're going to do like contrasting like tempos? Like, and so there were little ways that we would tell each other things on stage that the audience would not realize we were telling each other. Even to the point where we realized that only one of us on stage was good at maintaining the time. Like, we had a 30-minute show, and every time we rehearsed, ended up doing an hour and a half show. And we're like, what time is it? What? Somebody have a timer on their phone? Like, nobody knew what it was except for one person. They were like, well, I just thought we wanted to do it long. And I was like, stop us. Stop us.
Come in with the finale. Come in with the finale.
So we made a rule that when it was 5 minutes left in the show, that person would say something, make a French reference, like either France or French fries, or they'd say a word that was French, or they'd talk about something that was like, you know, a baguette or something. Like if they mentioned anything that was like specifically drew our, you know, it was like French. We were like, oh, I see what time it is. And we'd be like, got it. And then we'd get ready to do the finale. Yeah. But it was like, we would be like deep into these things, man. What do we do?
I love it so much.
We wrote a musical together, which we like wrote and got other actors to be in on top of, there were five of us and we got more people to be in. It was called Cement Boy, about a guy who had a cement block on his head and he just wanted to be liked, you know?
Yeah.
And it was like,
universal story.
I can't believe that we wrote Cement Boy, but it was like, we really wanted an hour and a half musical. And so we're like, well, let's just book a show. We're like, can we have this slot in 3 months? And they're like, yeah, I guess. Great. Oh, we're going to do so Cement much. Boy. Oh my God. I haven't thought about Cement Boy in forever. Oh, wild.
You need to think more about Cement Boy.
You're right. I do.
He thinks about you.
I bet he does. Absolutely. Oh man. I'm thinking about all the costumes. All right. No, we're talking about you. You are doing musical improv and sometime you're going to get back into teaching those. Now, are you mostly focused on teaching or do you do performances with Jamie doing musical improv as well?
I'm probably more a performer these days. In fact, I've never strayed from performance. I'm one of those gun. I like to call myself a gun for hire. I mean, it's not necessarily a good gun. It could be like just an old musket that's going to, you know, blow back in your face if you're not careful. But I don't really belong to any particular troop is more or less what I mean. But I will happily perform with whoever has space on their stage for me. And I'm very, very grateful and very lucky that because of the way I moved here and the way I had met people in Melbourne. So I'd come from Sydney, but every time I came to Melbourne for festivals or to see my partner, I would just be immersed in the scene here. So I would meet all the different people from all the different troupes or the stand-ups or the sketch writers or anyone doing anything. And so they all became my friends. And so when I came down here, I got lots of people inviting me to play with them. So I've had affiliations, like strong affiliations with structured organizations like Impro Melbourne is a bona fide company that runs classes. But there's other groups that don't necessarily run classes or run them very sporadically. So it's not like there's an ongoing space for teaching. So I just will happily do whatever shows someone invites me to be cast in. And I feel very, very, very grateful that I keep getting invitations. So I met Jamie in a troupe called Impromptunes, which do long form musicals here. We didn't splinter off or anything like that. I just, because I kind of come and go to different groups, it depends on what's happening. I'm a mum as well. So sometimes I can't commit to whole seasons with one troupe because, you know, and the way casting works and the way ensembles work is sometimes you do need to commit hard to a season or a year or, you know, a space of time. So I did commit with Impromptunes for quite a while, and then I moved to do something else, and then I moved to do something else. And Impromptunes are amazing and have kind of opened the gateway for me for a whole heap of other musical improv people who I will work in other arenas, which is quite nice. We don't have, there's not firm lines here of who you have to work with. Some people draw them, good on them, if that's what their thing is. But there's a whole heap of us who happily, you know, step over all the lines, and it's all just a bit, who do we like to work with? And have you got, you got a show? Yeah, great. I can do that date. So it's a bit more like that down here. We have quite a few rolling festivals in Melbourne. Melbourne's, got quite a lot of that. And we've got, you know, hopefully after we're in our sixth hard lockdown now with at least another month to go, probably. We've just had our Fringe Festival cancelled. So everybody's dealing with the aftermath of that. And we're really, really hoping that venues survive and that, you know, hopefully by summer maybe we'll be in a position to maybe start doing some shows again. you know, fingers crossed. But I will all come out just with all of our ideas, and like, he just wants to get together, get the gang back together. So yeah, right now teaching's something that I love to do and I will do again. But performance is probably the hunger I need to satisfy first. So, you know, I'll be probably looking more for what I can do performance wise, but it's such a strange thing. I've been, there was a small window of opportunity, for us where we could make some stuff. And I was very lucky to be cast in a TV show. So that's coming out at the end of this month. A mini series that I'm in, and I've been making some other sketches that are for a satirical, like a current affairs program here, and all of that's come out of the woes of COVID and all of those things. So, and voiceover work, because of course everyone can do stuff from home, so I have a setup for when I need to do that. And yeah, so I think I can't really even define what's next, because I think it's what opportunity is next that feels like it's the most worth of my energy, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because everything is, and you know this, like, I think this is something that I immediately understand with you, is you're a mother. Family time's really, like, if you're taking time away, it needs to be good time, right? It needs to be, if I'm not earning money doing it, if it's time away from my family or it's time, it needs to be worth it. I need to, you know, I need to feel like I'm getting, that could sound quite harsh, but, you know, time is a commodity for, yeah. I mean, it is for everybody, but for mothers, it really, really is, I think. And,
oh yeah, it's hard to schedule stuff, and I have to pick the projects that I like really, really want to do, because I have to then, you know, find babysitters and arrange for specific days. Yeah. I'm doing a short film coming up, and scheduling that is a nightmare. Like, and I feel so bad for them. I'm like, guys, just, I'm so sorry. Like, and I like found a babysitter that like is a friend within the crowd, so I was like, okay, he's gonna be a good babysitter because he knows us, and so he'll be okay with us doing this for this period of time, blah, blah, blah. But I'm like, I'm just always like, they'll be like, hey, can you come tomorrow? I'm like, no,
yeah,
I can't. I go, I'm real sorry, I can't do last minute anything. Like, and it's just because it's like, in order for me to leave my current situation, it requires a lot of effort, right?
Yeah, right.
And I don't have, like, my mother doesn't live here. Like, I don't have, like, a set-up babysitter. You know, there's no situation. And also these days, like, I'm glad I found some adult person that I trust and know to come and do the babysitting. This person is not a babysitter. But I was like, okay, this is COVID. Like, I can't have a stranger in my house, so I need somebody. Or like a young child babysitter who I am then putting in like at danger, because they're my space with my kid who goes to school. And like, it's way more complicated now to find a ding-dang babysitter. Yeah. So it's hard, and I'm glad that you found a way to do it. It gives me hope as my child gets older that I will be able to do stuff. I'm like, wow, so many things that you do. I feel like I do like one thing every 6 months, and I'm like, God, that I'm amazing. Yes.
Like, it does get easier as they get older, because you can a different circle emerges, which is the people that they trust, their friends, the parents that you like, that you go, they know what you do. And, you know, especially if they're not in, you know, a performance circle or the circle that kind of get your hours, but if they understand what you do, then they kind of get why you need to ask. It has gotten easier as we've gotten older, as he's gotten older, because we've just got stronger bonds with a few more people, because I'm not from here as well. I'm like you, I don't have family in this place, and so I don't have direct family in Melbourne.
I feel the same way about like Texas versus like, I'm like, my people aren't here. And I don't know like how many miles, you know, Sydney is from Melbourne, but like in the States, like I am halfway across the country from where I grew up. So it's like, I really don't even have aunts and uncles around. Like, there's not I could have gone 3 states away from where I grew up and still had like a little network. I could have called some people, but no, No.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's the difference between, we were talking about our generation earlier about, you know, we were the people who took care of ourselves as kids and then later moved away. Like a lot. I feel like there's a ton of people who didn't, who like don't move away from where they grew up now or whatnot. But I feel like everyone I know that I grew up with is all, you know, like seeds to the wind. They're like gone. Nobody's nearby. They're like the entire class. It's like, yeah, if we're coming to a high school reunion, we're all flying in. Like nobody's around anymore. It's just, you know, we wanted to have some adventure and now we're doing it. And it turns out we need babysitters. So
we need babysitters. Yeah.
Guys, if you're listening, if you're listening this far and you like me and you live in Austin, you want to be my babysitter, seriously, send me an email. seriously. But the other fun thing is like, I love saying little things right here in the like end bits of the podcast because of like, you've listened this far into our conversation. Like you love me, like, or you're like super
now's
into
the
theater. So yeah,
now's
so it's like, hey, remember how you were friends?
If you were thinking to yourself, how could I support Amy Moore? How can I just show her that I care? I mean, listening's one thing, but there's got to be one more tangible
could
way.
Be more. She hasn't set up that Patreon, so I can give her money yet. So clearly, I should.
I used to have so much. Yeah, I mean, you're doing content. I used to be a little bit like eyebrow raised about Patreon. And then I was asked to set one up for someone else just, you know, to do some admin. I was like, this is work. People who have set up a Patreon do deserve your money because, damn it, it is work to maintain that.
Yeah, you have to maintain it too. Like, it's not like you write it and like, okay, that's it. Thanks for your cash.
No, you
it's like a regular... I don't know. Maybe when he's older, I'll be able to do that. I can't. I mean, like, I can consistently get an episode out once a week. And even that, I'm clawing my way till making it. It's like 11:30 the night before. And I'm like, okay, last edit, you know. Oh, my God. Okay, so one last thing I want to ask you about, and you mentioned this a little bit earlier, but I would be interested in, like, how you are – you know, creatively exciting yourself right now. You mentioned sewing, but like, is what is it that you are doing that's like stoking the fires of new ideas? Are you like watching stuff? Are you reading stuff? Is it just the relaxed brain moment as you're sewing, like that helps the ideas flow? Cause we're improvisers, right? Like if we have a skill, it's that we can come up with ideas, a lot of them, fast.
Yeah.
Right? So you got to keep that brain rocking and rolling. And when I am dormant, which, you know, having a four-year-old, you know, I have a lot of dormant moments. There's so many ideas. I mean, I still have a joke notebook. I'm not telling jokes. I don't do stand up, but I still write things down. Oh, that's a good idea. Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's funny.
Of course you do. You're not a fool. See that gold you need to record just in case. Yeah, it is a hard thing. I've felt a little bit like I've had to readjust again the way I think. We had a small window of opening down here where we got to do some shows at the beginning of the year. We had our comedy festival, which felt really, really hopeful. And then I got cast in the show, so that was great. But then we've just been in some rolling lockdowns again. We were preparing for a fringe festival, so I've been writing a show with a group of people, a variety show. And, stepping outside of my comfort zone, it is a scripted piece, so I'm not relying on improv. I'm relying on some stuff that I've created through improv, though, a cabaret character I have. I made her up in a show, and I was just like, I'm going to do something with her. So she's got a space in this show, and we've just found out today that it's more than likely cancelled because I don't think it'll translate to anything online. So we're looking at that being cancelled. But the great thing is that we're not going to stop writing it, and we'll just move the date for that. But I think the big thing for me has been readjusting what I think creativity is. So the skills that I have, I don't need to feel like there has to be a show at the end of it for me to be utilizing those skills regularly. So I do some voiceover work, which, you know, keeps, but that strangely that's not that creative. I'm reading someone else's words and recording it. I do try to put a bit of, you know, Buckley pizzazz into it, for sure. But it's not. It legitimizes my skills, but it doesn't necessarily make me feel overly creative.
Sure.
And I'm very grateful for the job because it pays me.
I guess.
But I've been working one of the corporate connections that I have through improv has from last year's lockdown developed an app, which is all about the app itself is a people app. And so I've been working alongside those people developing content for the app itself, which is, you know, tapping into a lot of the stuff I would have done in person if they had hired me as the improviser to run a workshop with a group of corporates who need some help either delivering feedback or, you know, all the things that improvisers get hired to work with corporate organizations for. So I've been working with in that space, helping create content, which actually has felt like creativity, because it's meant I've had lots of conversations with people. It's meant that I've had ideas of theirs spark inspiration through me, which has been lovely. Oh, that reminds me of a thing. And then I'll read something that I'll just go, people are great. The world's not, I mean, it's not a great place at the moment, but it's not, all hope isn't lost. So I find that that has helped me keep in contact, in connection with some people. And it's utilizing these skills that over the years I've had to, admit, you know, are useful, not just on stage, which, was a great thing to admit, but also it changes what you define success as. So if you had have told me 22-year-old Amanda, getting the call from the agent, taking her first improv classes, you know, that you'll one day feel successful as an improviser and actor because of some corporate content you've written, I would have said, I don't think so. But actually that has brought me quite a lot of satisfaction this year and stuff that I'm very proud of. So I think that's where I've adjusted my thinking. And in true kind of improviser form, I've been flexible and adaptable. And I think it suddenly dawned on me, oh, I've been improvising all year without an audience. But, you know, sometimes you don't need an audience.
Sometimes all conversations with strangers are improv. I feel exactly. Like it's so much harder to speak to people these days, like out in the world. Like I'm that wacky gal who makes conversation in the grocery store. Like I wander Love around, it. I'm like beans, am I right? Like, but it's really way harder now because now we're all each other's like scary, you know, murderer, and yeah. And we are all wearing masks, so we're also bandits, and so you're walking around, so. I still talk, but people don't know where it's coming from, right? I'm loud so that you can hear me through the mask. I've got loud too.
Yeah, we smell our own.
But people, I'll still try to be all like, oh man, look at that. Like, and I try to engage as many people in a at once, right? And it's usually with something like there's some big display and I'm like, man, they want us to buy some lemons, am I right? And then I look around and I usually get one person like, yeah. And that's like my, I'm like, yeah, what's up?
So much. In the age of the mask, people like you and I, our eyebrows are working overtime to kind of deliver that you don't need to fear us.
I do a lot of shoulder bobs now too. A lot of shoulder action, you know? You know,
you can't be scared of a shimmy.
You can't. You can't.
It's fun.
I also
I'm a good time gal. I love that.
Yeah. I mean, but you know, if I have, we were talking about using our skills in ways that we didn't expect to use them. And I am funny and can put people at ease. And if people don't need both of those things, I mean, it's absolutely necessary right now. So everywhere I am, I make a joke. I say something silly. I make myself the butt of it. Like, so I actually am a larger lady. And so sometimes my butt knocks into things, you know, it's a mind of its own. Right. And when I do, I make a big deal, but in a real funny way so that everyone gets a good laugh out of it. Right. And not like pre-COVID, like I would be so embarrassed. I'm like, oh my God. But the world's just a little bit darker now. So that when something silly happens, I immediately become like a slapstick comedian. Like, I'm like, wow, I'm falling. Like, it's just not, you know, and then everybody's looking and I'm like putting up the cans that I've knocked over. And I'm like, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to do it. Oh my God, these cans, they're all broken. And people are just staring at me like, is anyone even said anything to her? Like, she's not in trouble. Why is she doing this monologue? Yeah.
I love that though, because you know that you have made a whole family's night, because that person is going home and saying, everyone listen up. You're not going to believe what I just saw.
Yes.
And then they're all laughing. Yeah. You're spreading joy.
I'm trying my best.
The only thing missing is like a Foley track of cartoon noises.
I just cue it up comedy on my phone and I just press a button and it's like, and I'm like, whoa. Yeah. I like just choreograph a whole thing and like make it happen. No, I don't like to be too organized about my, you know, pop-up theater in the middle of the grocery store. No, I just sort of look around, like with everything, you know, I look around to see who's kind of got their face like, this is the drudge of my life. And then I like swing over to them and I'm all like, which peas should I get? And they're like, what? And I was like, seriously, I've never bought peas before. Do you know which one's better? And like, people are just like, I don't know. Could you just pick one? I can't decide. And then like, okay. And what's hilarious is that my child, you know, he goes to the grocery store with me and he is equally as gregarious. And hasn't gone in a little while, but previously he was going. And so he would just randomly talk to people. We'd be there and he's great. He's so funny. He gives compliments to strangers. So he'd be like, I like your hat. Or like, nice shoes. And like, people then want to talk to him. And then they turn and they're like, oh, it's an adorable baby who's talking to me. I mean, he's 4. He's not a baby. He tells me every time I call him a baby, I was like, you're my baby. I'm not a baby, mama. I'm a boy. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Good to know. Thank you. I appreciate you. But, you know.
Who doesn't want a compliment from a gorgeous kid?
Right?
Know? Like.
That's why I trained him to just give compliments. So he just tells everyone pleasant things. And he's not disingenuous.
No.
At all.
And I imagine he's not just saying everybody's hat is great. He's finding out the genuine good hat.
Yeah.
He's finding out the genuine great shoes.
Yeah.
Hey, check out your frames, you know, like, I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
He's so funny.
It's such a weird, people, why don't we give more compliments, you know?
Oh, I love giving compliments.
Give a compliment.
Yeah. I love it. It's my favorite. You know the phrase, if you don't have anything good to say, don't say anything at all. My phrase is the opposite, which is if you have something good to say, say it.
Yeah.
Like if you glance over and it's like the prettiest sweater you've ever seen, you sidle right up there and just be like, hey, that sweater is gorgeous. Lady to lady, we all know we do that. And then the best response, here's my favorite. Their response is like, oh my God, I got it at TJ Maxx for $10. And you're like, what? Like the most obscure, like the random, like you'll never find a good thing here. Or like the lowest price you could possibly imagine for a sweater of that magnitude. And you're like, $10, what a deal. You know, like that's my favorite part of being a lady is just like trying to lower with like what it is.
Yeah.
I like your sweater. I got it for $1.50 at Goodwill. Yeah. No. Yes. They tried to give it to me for free, but I said, I want you to have the donation. That's amazing.
Oh, like you said with getting a haircut, it's like, wow, your hair looks amazing. It was an accident. I couldn't even see what was happening. I had my glasses off.
I've never seen a haircut. I've never seen it. It's always a surprise. It's always a surprise.
It's so good. I love that.
It's such deep trust. And every time when I tell people that I've had hairdressers where I've gone back over and over because, you know, once you get one that's pretty good, COVID ruined all that, unfortunately. All of my people are gone. But at the same time, it was like, I used to go back because it was like, I can really relax. Like when I get haircuts, yes, I am enjoying the tactile function of like somebody touching my head. And so I can distract myself with that while I'm like, you could look like anything at all when you put these glasses back on. But then when you find somebody that you really trust, you really get to relax. It's like an extra salon detail because I take the glasses off and I was like, no matter what, she's going to make me look great. She does it every time. Okay.
That's
like,
right.
And it's just like so great.
And feel good.
Man, now I want to go to a salon. Damn it.
So many things you miss.
Oh, goodness. First a salon, then an improv theater. Okay. Oh, my goodness. Amanda, thank you so much for talking to me. I know that it was like wild scheduling and we're literally on the opposite sides of the earth and we're chatting. And even when you said, hopefully by summer, and I was like, it's in the, No, absolutely. I talked to lots of people internationally. I was just immediately in my brain like, what happened? Oh, that's right. Other hemisphere, legit. Like, you know, the beauty thing about being a creative in this time period, even though we're in this weird crossroads of not being able to be in person, is that I feel like the international connections are so much stronger. And the ability for us to talk to each other every day on like Facebook and have these conversations, like, I wouldn't ever want to live in another time, because in this time I can speak to somebody who I can befriend and we are as far apart as humans can be on the, like, on the globe that we live on. Like, it's so mind-blowing and amazing. And it's like, I, you know, your phrase, you smell your own, I was going to say, you're a kindred spirit. and it's like
the puffiest sleeves without... if you're giving me Savannah of Green Gables, you've got the puffiest sleeves.
But it's like, how great is it that we get to even meet?
I know. It is, there are things that if you stop, if you take a breath, your mind will be boggled at actually how good it is. Yeah. I mean, there's a, because we're just bombarded with the negative. So there's no denying all the, you know, the absolute mess, humanity is in.
Sure,
but as individuals, if we stop, I mean, it's incredible.
Yeah. The amount that we've accomplished, the technology, even the science, I'm like, this, we are the best crowd to get a pandemic. They've got so many doctors. You know how many doctors there are? You know how many doctors who legit are working on just this right now? So many in every country.
Yeah.
Everywhere. That's some solid work. That's some solid solidarity. That is like, to use a word I'm tired of hearing in a positive spin, unprecedented. Like, it is amazing.
It really is.
And good. And like, gosh, yes. So, I'm so glad we got to talk. I'm so glad that we got to connect and that the creative world is such that, you know, we are able to continue to connect. I'm sure I had 1,000 more questions for you about Australian festivals, but as soon as the world opens up, I'm just going to call you again and be all like, so how do I get in on those 6 or 7 festivals you got going on in that town?
I'll make it happen.
Right? Yeah. Absolutely. 2025, I'm doing a world tour. So it's just going to go all around. I know it's a few years in the future, but, you know.
It's safer to think a few years. Yeah, that's selfish. We're not in a rush. It's going to be quality and it's going to be good.
Well, you know, and also to be honest, like realistically, I would love to go around, but the infrastructure of theaters is going to have to rebuild and, you know, give them a couple years. And then we know where the spaces are and who's actually doing stuff and people have figured themselves out.
Yeah. You don't want to turn up and it's moved down the road, you know?
Sure. I flew all the way here. It's a block down the road. I'm leaving.
Sorry.
I got an Airbnb next to this building. It's no longer here. Oh, man. Man. All right. You're great. Thank you for being on the podcast.
And thank you so much.
It's been so great.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.